Daniel chapter 2. Amazingly enough, we got to Daniel chapter 2 about 6 weeks quicker than we got to James chapter 2. Imagine how that works out. But Daniel chapter 2, when you're dealing with narrative, you can move a little more quickly. Daniel chapter 2, and if you'll recall, in Daniel chapter 1, we looked at what I call the faithful four, which are these four young men, most likely teenagers, possibly even on the lower end of the teen years, who find themselves quite literally imported into Babylon, and they are four among some of the best and the brightest, and they are imported into Babylon as part of this elaborate plot from Nebuchadnezzar to try to brainwash them with these Babylonian ideals, so that way when the rest of the rest of the kingdom arrives, here they are, and they can be indoctrinated by their own people, right? And so we talked about the fact that, you know, like Daniel, we live in a world that doesn't honor God, doesn't value God, doesn't want to serve God, wants to try to force their ideals on us, wants to try to tempt us and lure us away from our commitment to God with their perceived niceties. But Daniel and his four friends stand firm. And if you remember last week, we looked at the response of Daniel and his four friends to... Say again? There was four of them. The faithful four. So Daniel and his three friends, the four of them combined, they come up with this plan, and they ask to be allowed for 10 days to not participate in the king's meat and in the king's wine. And they said, after 10 days, let us be evaluated, and if we're not up to snuff, then you can punish us however you feel the need to punish us. But we ask that you would give us 10 days to prove ourselves. And so they agree, and for 10 days they eat pulse, which is essentially vegetables and water. And after 10 days, we see that they were, as verse 15 says, fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portions of the king's meat. And so God took care of them. God honored them for their faith. God honored them for their commitment. And it really turned out very well for them. And then when they go before the king finds them to be better by a margin of 10 than all the other children of Israel that were brought. And so at the end of Daniel chapter 1, we see that Daniel and his three friends, the four of them together, are elevated to this high position. And then we read in verse 21 that Daniel actually continues there for like 60-some years until the first year of the reign of King Cyrus, who was a Medo-Persian. And so all of that's by way of background. And we pick up in Daniel chapter 2, and we read a very interesting story about Nebuchadnezzar and how God is proving himself in new ways to Nebuchadnezzar, and God is showing through Daniel and his three friends that he is the King of Kings and he is the Lord of Lords, and he is far superior to any of these perceived or made up gods of Babylon. And so we pick up in Daniel chapter 2, verse 1, and we read, "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, or dreamed a dream, dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him." And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and his dream is pretty confusing. And he really didn't understand what his dream meant, and his dream troubled him. And in Babylonian society, it was believed that the gods would often communicate through dreams. And of course, we know in this case that that was true. It just wasn't a Babylonian god. It was the god. And of course, you know, we know that God these days does not speak to us through dreams because we have a closed canon of Scripture. We have the sum total of God's revelation here in our hands. But at this time, God's word was still being revealed. And of course, this is part of it because we're reading it now. And so it was a common thing for God to speak through dreams, and it was believed that the gods, little g, plural, also spoke through dreams. And so Nebuchadnezzar in his spirit says, okay, the gods are trying to tell me something, but I don't know what it is. And so he has this really weird dream. He doesn't know what it means. The nature of the dream is such that it produces some level of anxiety in him to the point where he can't sleep. And I wonder if that's ever happened to any of us, where, you know, something happens and it produces so much anxiety in us that we really can't sleep. And when I think about this, the thing that really pops into my mind first is several years ago, I had just gotten, so Ellie had just been born, and I had just gotten ordained. And first of the year, my boss came to me and he said, hey, you're going to the ministry, that's great. You got a kid now, that's great. But those two things are taking up too much of your time, you're fired. So I had like a 1 month, 1.5 month old baby and no job. So that was kind of stressful, but you know, I had some skills. And so while I was looking for a job, I was doing like odd and end jobs, you know, handyman stuff here and there. And we had a family in our church that were moving. And at that point, my specialty was like punch list repairs and that kind of stuff. And they said, hey, we've got a punch list of repairs that we need done. Would you do them? And I said, yeah, sure. I'll give you the friends and family discount. So I did these jobs for them, gave them a discount, got paid. And then the husband says, hey, actually, we'd like to have the whole house painted. Would you paint the whole house? And I said, yep, here's my quote. I can paint the whole house. I said, just know I am looking for a full-time job. And so if I get a job, my timetable might be pushed back a little bit. You know, is that okay? He said, yeah, that's fine. So I agreed to paint their house. I start the work. Well, then I get a full-time job. And so, I called the husband. I said, hey, I just got a full-time job. And so my timetable is going to be pushed back a little bit. But if you're comfortable with me finishing your house, I'll finish your house. He said, sure. So I put in a lot of nights, a lot of weekends, and I got it done. But I ended up about 2-3 weeks behind schedule. Well, his wife was not happy with that. And the whole time I'm doing the work, she's texting me and she's nitpicking. Oh, it looks horrible. I'm like, well, yeah, I still have to put a second coat on, you know. I get the second coat on. She goes, oh, I can still see the paint coming through. I said, no, I did two coats. You can't see it. I said, that's just your brain because you know what color it used to be. But I mean, this wife, she was nitpicking everything. And when it came time to pay me, she didn't want to pay me. She's like, well, you took longer than you said you were going to do, and you didn't give us a discount. You said you were going to give us a discount, and you didn't give us a discount. I said, yeah, I did. I said, you know, you can see on the invoice that I gave you a discount. No, you didn't give us a discount. It's not on here. And I said, well, you know, and I explained to her, yes, I did give you a discount, and I explained to her how I gave her the discount. Well, it's not on here. I said, well, would you like me to rewrite the invoice? And you know, like, it's on there. Trust me, it's on there. No, you didn't give us a discount, and you know, you took longer, and I'm not going to pay you. And I mean, these I don't know if I said this. These are people I went to church with. Like, I had their kids in my junior church class, and I tell you what, that produced so much anxiety in me. And that night, I did not close my eyes the whole night. I was just so upset about all this. And finally, I told her, I said, look, you pay me what you want to pay me, and we're going to be done with it. Well, I don't think I should have to pay you anything. I said, I'm going to give it to the Lord. I'm going to let it go. You do what you think is right. Well, she ended up paying me about half, and then never spoke another word to me. And I found out later that we had a mutual friend. And so I was talking to him one day, and I said, hey, you know, I hear you know. And I said their name, and he goes, oh, run. I said, well, it's too late now. And I told him the story, and he said they did the exact same thing to me. He was a realtor, and they did the exact same thing to him, never said a word to him afterwards. And, you know, the husband was the nicest guy on the planet and kept apologizing for his wife, but he didn't have the courage to stand up to her. And so it was just this whole big mess, and that night I did not get a wink of sleep. And I don't know if it was her concession that she paid me half, or if he talked her into paying me half when she was going to pay me none. I don't know. I ended up getting about half, and the whole thing was a nightmare. But I was in so much, I say all that to say, I had so much anxiety about all that. I mean, these are people I go to church with. Like, their kids are in my Sunday school or my junior church class, you know? And I had so much anxiety about that that I could not sleep. And until that issue was resolved, however it was resolved, I couldn't sleep. And that's where the king finds himself. He finds himself where he's had this dream, and his spirit is troubled so much so that his sleep is breaking from him. He can't sleep. And so what does he do? Verse 2, then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And so the king calls in these four groups of people, the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, and he asks them to interpret his dream. Now, it's important to understand who these groups of people are, and each of these groups of people are going to claim to have some extraordinary or some supernatural ability to be able to understand and foretell the universe or the world in some way. And so the magicians, those would be like fortune tellers. And so a magician is someone who would claim to be able to see the future, someone who would claim to be able to predict what's going to happen next. An astrologer, on the other hand, is someone who would claim to be able to read the stars and to be able to derive information from the alignment of the stars. We were talking at lunch about birthdays, and Brother Hayden was saying that his birthday is in December, and he's like, I don't know what my astrological sign is. You know, we were kind of joking about that a little bit. But this is that, right? They believe that the alignment of the stars and the constellations, being able to read the stars would give you some supernatural or some extraordinary understanding of the world, of the created order. And so that's what an astrologer would claim. Sorcerers are a sorcerer is someone who would claim to be able to speak with spirits, someone who would be able to or claim to be able to manipulate spiritual energies. And then the Chaldeans, as this last group to round out the roster, these would be resident people of Babylon who were highly educated in science and religion. And they would claim enlightenment, and they would claim understanding of the universe through enlightenment. And so he calls all these groups of people together, these four groups of people, and he says, hey, I want you to tell me what this means. And he's probably thinking, okay, between the four, the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, someone's got to be able to make sense of this, right? So he calls them in. It says, and the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, and they said, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show, or we will give you the interpretation. So Nebuchadnezzar gathers them all together, and he asks them to interpret his dream. And a Chaldean says this phrase. He says, O king, live forever. Tell us your dream, and we'll tell you what it means. And that first phrase, O king, live forever, that's something that you see a lot as a greeting for rulers. And sometimes you would say it because you liked the king and you wanted him to stay in power and you would especially want him to stay in power if you had a reason to dislike or distrust who was coming next, the heir. And the last time that I preached through Daniel was about 3-4 years ago, and so I literally have a note here that says, here's looking at you, Charles. And so that's a little bit of history there for you. I think Charles is objectively not as good as his mother. But anyways, and so this is something that you would say, not only because perhaps you liked the king and you wanted him to stay in power, but this is also something that you would say because you liked your position and you wanted to maintain the good favor of the king. And so saying something like, oh, king, I hope you rule forever, makes him feel good, right? It kind of plays on his good side. But there's another reason why you might say this. In Babylon and in some of these pagan societies, it was believed that the king essentially had God status by virtue of being the king. And so they, not quite like the Pope, where, you know, the Pope, like, can speak for God or whatever, but they believed that the king actually, like, had some sort of godness that came with being the king, kind of this God status or this God power. And so this is something that you would say to remain in the good graces of the king, especially if you felt like your gifts, your supernatural gifts, extended through him. But needless to say, no one would ever dare say anything negative to the king because they don't want to compromise their life. They don't want to compromise their job. And so these Chaldeans, they're praising the king. They're kind of buttering him up. And they say, okay, king, you're the best. We hope you live forever. We love you. You're so great. You're wonderful. It would be our pleasure to interpret this dream. And we think this dream is going to just be a wonderful thing for you. And so just tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means. Well, there's a problem. Nebuchadnezzar didn't want to tell him the dream. We see that in verse 5 when he says, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. He says, if you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. And that phrase where he says, the thing is gone from me, some people interpret that as the king saying, hey, I really can't remember the dream, right? It's just kind of, you know, sometimes you have a dream and like the minute you wake up, like you kind of have this like fuzzy, vague recollection of the dream, but you really can't remember what happened. Does that happen to any of y'all? That happens to me sometimes. And so some people would say, oh, the king just, he couldn't remember the dream. It was gone from him. But that doesn't seem to be the case here. If I understand the Aramaic properly, this verb here where he says the thing is gone from me, a lot of other translations say that the thing is firm or the commandment is established from me. And so he's not saying, hey, I can't remember. He's saying, no, I don't want to tell you the dream. I've told you to interpret the dream. Now do it. And it's interesting because essentially what the king is doing here is he's trying to put them to the test, right? He's trying to get them to prove that they really are who they say they are and that they really can do what they claim to do, right? You know, you say that you have this position and you say you have this supernatural authority or you say you have this divine enlightenment or you have this connection to the mystical or the astrological. Prove it. Tell me the dream. Tell me the interpretation. And I'll know that you guys really are the real deal. But hey, if you don't, I'm going to cut you in pieces and your houses will be made a dunghill. Well, and you might say, well, that seems kind of extreme, but think about it. You know, here's these groups of men. And if they really don't have the power that they say they are, then they're a bunch of frauds. They've been lying to the king, all right? And the punishment for lying to the king has to be severe because if it's not, then everybody's going to do it, all right? And so he's essentially putting them to the test. He's making them prove their power, right? He recognizes that anybody can put a good spin on a story, right? Like how many of us when we were kids got caught doing something we weren't supposed to do and were able to some degree to talk our way out of it or at least to talk mom and dad down in terms of punishment, right? Like we can all kind of spin a good story. We can all kind of justify our actions. You know, we're all pretty good at that naturally, aren't we? And so he doesn't want them to do that. And so he wants them to be able to recount something that happened to him or something that happened to someone else in their case. And he wants them to be able to recount this in perfect detail. And he knows that this is going to be the ultimate proof of power. Hey, if you guys really are the real deal, this shouldn't be a problem for you, right? The issue, though, is that, you know, this, I call this the magic council. The issue, though, is that the magic council doesn't have that power. There's only one person who has that power, right? And we're gonna meet that person, or we're going to see that person here in a little bit. And so the magic council recognizes that what the king's asking them to do is kind of problematic. And we see that in verse 6. I get ahead of myself. He says, if you don't, I'm going to cut you in pieces. I'm going to make your house a dunghill. They didn't have plumbing. They didn't have septic tanks. So it could be that he was literally saying, I'm going to make your house, you know, the next dump site of the city waste. Or it could be that he's just kind of exaggerating a little bit, like when your mom says, if you don't get it together, I'm going to knock you into the middle of next week. She's not actually going to knock you into the middle of next week, but at the same time, there is a very serious threat that's being made, right? She's not saying that nothing's going to happen. Like, something's going to happen, and it's going to be something bad. I'm not going to literally knock you into the middle of next week, but there is going to be punishment, and it's going to be severe. And so it could just be that he's saying, you know, hey, I'm gonna cut you in pieces. I'm gonna knock your house down, and I'm just gonna wipe you off the planet. And that's a very serious thing there. And so he's saying, you have to tell me the dream. You have to tell me the meaning. If you don't, it's gonna be a problem for you. Well, the magic council, I get ahead of myself again. He says, but if you can, if you do show me the dream, if you do show me the interpretation, then I'll know that you're for real. I'll know you're the real deal and that you haven't been lying to me. And here's what I'm going to give you. You shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. He promises them riches and blessings if they can get the job done. Well, the problem is they can't get the job done, can they? And so this really isn't a good thing for them. And so we see in verse 7, it says, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation thereof. Look, king, just tell us the dream. We'll tell you what it means. But the king refuses. He says in verse 8, the king answered and said, I know of certainty that ye would gain the time, because ye see the thing has gone for me. And that phrase, gain the time, is basically just you're stalling for time. You're trying to get yourself some more time. You're trying to stall here because you know I'm not going to tell you the dream. And so you're just trying to kind of, you know, give yourself a few minutes to try to think of something to do. Right? They're stalling. And he knows that. You're just trying to gain the time. You see the thing is gone from me. You see I'm firm. I'm not going to tell you the dream. I'm going to make you prove yourself. Quit stalling and get to it. Then he continues. He says, but if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. He says, if you won't tell me the dream and the interpretation, that means you don't have these magical powers that you've been claiming, and that in turn means that you've all just been lying to me to make me feel good as long as it serves your purposes. And then when the circumstances change, right, till the time be changed, when the circumstances change and something better comes along, you're going to abandon me and walk away. You're going to go serve some other king. He says, so tell me the dream and tell me the interpretation or else. And so this really puts the magic council in a really tough spot, right? I mean, they literally are backed into a corner here. And their life is on the line, and so they really dispense with the pleasantries with which they started, and we really see them go on the offensive. And the Chaldeans especially, who are these resident, you know, science experts, it says the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. By the way, I agree with that statement wholeheartedly, don't you? Yeah, I agree with that statement. He says, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. Look, man, what you're asking for is ridiculous. All right, there is not a king on this planet that has ever asked anybody to do what you're asking us to do because it can't be done. There is not a man on this planet that can do what you're asking for us to do. And they were right, by the way. Right? We agree with that statement. But they continue. They said, and it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. They said, only the gods can do what you're asking, but they don't deal with mankind. right? In this culture and others of its day, the gods were viewed as being these transcendent, you know, distant beings whose favor we had to earn and whose wrath had to be appeased with these different pagan offerings and sacrifices and rituals. And this, in turn, by the way, adds to the salutation of verse, was it 6? Verse 4, where they said, you know, O king, live forever. You know, the idea that the king is an extension of the gods. And so, really, they felt like in order to get what they wanted from the gods, they needed to earn their favor, they needed to appease their wrath to get their way. And so these false gods, they just weren't involved. But we serve a God who is involved, right? We serve a God who is transcendent, but we serve a God who is also immanent. And how is it that our God is both transcendent and immanent? It's because he's omnipresent, right? His presence occupies the totality of time and space. And so without realizing it, they are confessing that Daniel's God is better than their God. They just haven't seen it yet. And so they're really backed into a corner. They're really stalling for time. They're trying to talk their way out of this. They're going after the king, trying to get him to change his mind. Well, the king didn't like it. And so he says in verse 12, or we read in verse 12, for this cause, the king was angry. He was very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And so the king, in his anger, he gives the command to wipe them all out. You're useless, you're cowardly, you're manipulative, I'm done with all of you. The problem is, we saw in Daniel chapter 1 that the faithful four are part of this group. King didn't call them, but they're part of the group. And so this command from the king, it affects them too. And we see that in verse 13. It says, and the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. And so the command is given. The soldiers go to dispense with the king's decree, and they come to kill Daniel and his friends. And so yet again, the lives of Daniel and his friends are being threatened. But we're going to see that Daniel's response to the king is going to be very, very different from the response of this, I call it the magic council, right? These four groups of men. We read in verses 14 and 15, then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom. Well, that's something we didn't see from the other four groups. It says, Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. And so Daniel comes with counsel and wisdom, and he says, hey, chief guard, chief Arioch, hey, what's going on here? Why is the king all sudden trying to wipe us all out, and why is he trying to do it so quickly and so hastily? Like, why the rush? Like, why is the king so angry? And so the captain of the guard, Arioch, he tells Daniel the whole story. You know, hey, these four groups, or the king had this weird dream. He called these four groups in. He's trying to put them to the test, and they're just totally incompetent. They are a bunch of frauds. They can't do what the king wants them to do. And so they've really just been lying to the king and buttering him up for however many years they've been there. And the king is just done with them. He's angry, and so he wants y'all wiped out. And so here we are. Congratulations, you're getting wiped out. Well, Daniel, he goes and he makes an appeal to the king. It says, then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he should give him time and that he should show the king the interpretation. And so Daniel says, hey, king, can I have a few minutes of your time? Fine, whatever, what do you want? King, would you give me some time to make an appeal to my God? And it could very well be that my God will reveal to me the dream and the interpretation. And we're not going to get this far today, but you guys know the end of the story. You know that the Lord blesses Daniel yet again, and the Lord does reveal the dream. And when that happens, Daniel rightly gives all the credit where it belongs. All right, look, King, this isn't from me. This is from my God. I'm not doing this. My God is doing this for me, and my God is doing this for you. All right, and so he goes, and he makes his appeal to the king, that the king would give him time. And he said, and if you'll give me time, then I will give the king his dream and his interpretation. It says, then Daniel went to his house, and so the king obviously says yes. And so Daniel goes to his house, and he makes the thing known to his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. And so he gets this time, and he goes, and he tells his friends what's going on. He tells them about the arrangement that he's made with the king. And we see in verse 18 how they respond. It says, he told them the dream, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning the secret, that Daniel and his fellow soldiers should not that his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And so Daniel tells his friends about what's going on, and we see that the first thing that they do is they take it to the Lord. The first thing they do is they get on their knees and they pray. And just by way of application for us, you know, how often does a situation arise, and rather than taking time to seek the Lord about something, how many of us, like the king or like the wise men, we just immediately overreact. We just immediately try to take things into our own hands. And when we do that, we make things a lot worse for ourselves, right? You know, it's like, hey, if you would just take 5 minutes, if you would just calm down, you know, things might not be such a crisis. You might actually come up with a reasonable game plan. You know, when you act in the heat of the moment, things get burned, right? And so Daniel, he gets his time. He goes and tells his friends, and his friends immediately take it to the Lord. They immediately go to the Lord about it in prayer. They ask God to show mercy on them and reveal to them, or to reveal to Daniel, what the king wanted so that their lives could be spared. And what's interesting is that the answer to this prayer would also spare the lives of this magic council, which, you know, you would hope would result in them turning to the Lord and saying, hey, your God did what our gods couldn't do. But when we get to Daniel 6, we're going to see that probably wasn't the case. But nonetheless, we read in verse 19, and we'll leave off here for sake of time. But we read in verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And so God heard Daniel's prayer. God revealed the dream to him, and God revealed the meaning to him overnight. And you know, sometimes, by way of application, sometimes the solution to our problem is to seek the Lord and then sleep on it. You know, a lot of times we want to immediately address the problem. We want to immediately jump in and handle it. And it may seem counterintuitive to wait to respond. But sometimes the best thing you can do is seek the Lord and then sleep on it. And that's exactly what Daniel did. And we see that God reveals the dream to him. In Psalm chapter 3, we read about a time when David was running from his son Absalom, who was trying to kill him, and Absalom's trying to overthrow him. But David writes in Psalm 3, verses 4 through 5, he says, I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. He said, I laid me down and slept. I awaked, for the Lord sustained me. And so sometimes when we find ourselves in times of trouble and it seems like something's impossible, the first thing that we need to do is we need to seek the Lord. And then sometimes, as a follow-up to that, we need to wait to make a decision and to sleep on it. And that's what Daniel did. And so just by way of some takeaways here, and then we'll move into our discussion, three things. Like Daniel, We need to understand that sometimes the world's going to ask some impossible things of us. You know, if I'm Daniel, I might actually agree with the Magic Council and be like, dude, king, what you're asking for is ridiculous. And, you know, we don't necessarily contest that the king's request was ridiculous, because it was. But we need to understand that, like Daniel, sometimes the world is going to ask some pretty impossible things of us. We also need to realize, like Daniel, that sometimes life seems hopeless, or not really like Daniel, like the wise men. Life seems hopeless when we rely on our own strengths. You know, these four groups of men, these fakers, this magic council, they're trying to make their way through life on their own strength. And where that ends up for them is that they're backed in the corner, trying to plead, not really even plead, just kind of talk their way out of getting obliterated. And then point number three, like Daniel, we need to realize that we need to pray and entrust our problems to God. You know, Daniel didn't go into the king and say, king, look, man, you're being ridiculous here. Like, don't overreact. Just tell him the dream and get it over with. He doesn't say that. He entrusts his problems to the Lord, and he trusts the Lord completely to take care of them. And next week, we'll look at the fact that God answered his prayer, and God reveals the dream. And so the big takeaway is that we need to understand that the promises of God are clear. This is on your sheet, and prayer really works. I have three passages here for us to look at briefly, and then we'll go into our discussion. Psalm 25, verse 14, David says, "The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant." You know, this magic council, right, these fakers, they didn't have any access to any divine knowledge. They didn't have access to any supernatural power or ability or enlightenment or understanding. But the reality is Daniel did have access to all of that. He did have access to divine enlightenment. He did have access to supernatural power, and it was through his God. And we have that as well. We have the Word of God. We have the power of God. And so the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant. Psalm 84:11, this is one of the verses that I love. Psalm 84 might very well be my favorite psalm. But David says, "The Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory." He says, "No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly." God says, "I will work all things together for good if you love me and if you are called according to my purpose, if you are devoting your life to serving me." He says, "I'm going to take care of you. I'm not going to withhold good from you. I might lead you through some very deep valleys, and I might lead you through some very difficult things." He says, "But I am a sun and a shield. I will give you grace and glory, and I will not withhold any good thing from you. I will work everything out for your good." And then Philippians 4, verses 6 through 7, Paul admonishes us. He says, "Be careful," or "be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God." I don't think that magic council had very much peace while Daniel was sleeping. In fact, they might have pulled a King Nebuchadnezzar and didn't sleep at all that night. I don't know. We don't read it. But he says, "The peace of God, which passes or surpasses all understanding, will keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." And so when the world asks impossible things of us, rather than relying on our own strength, we need to pray and entrust our problems to God, knowing that he has the power to help us, and whatever the answer is that he gives, it will be for the best.